welcome back to another episode of Educating While Black. On today's episode, I have Susan. And Susan is someone that I've known for about 5 years when we went on a trip to Guyana as part of an international teacher development program. You may have heard that trip referenced on another episode. And so Susan, myself, and that person were all together in Guyana, and it was a very interesting experience. Susan's been teaching since 2006 and came through in a postgraduate route to the GTP. She's had mainly pastoral roles, so has been in charge of Key Stage 3 and Key Stage 4. I've been a head of year in a number of different schools. And in September 2020, is going to become a head of sixth form in a London school as well. And a very interesting thing about Susan is at the time I met her, I think Susan was telling me that she was just over equal. Half her experience had been, or half her existence had been in Jamaica, and half her existence had been in the UK. So that's something I definitely remember about, that sort of duality of experience. It's a very interesting experience for Susan to go to Guyana, so a country similar in kind to Jamaica, and have an experience there that I guess would have been more similar to what she grew up around. So I'm looking forward to seeing what we talk about in this episode. And I'm going to ask Susan to introduce a bit more of herself to you. So over to you. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Marlon. Thank you so much for that. Yeah, I'm from Jamaica. I grew up there. I did all my education there. And I came to London in 1999, June of 1999. And to say it was a culture shock was an understatement. I genuinely was not expecting what I came to see when I arrived. But, you know, being from Jamaica, you know how to be adaptable and resourceful. So I used my skills of adaptability and being resourceful. And I've always wanted to be a teacher. That was the main thing for me. You know, back in Jamaica, I would talk to my friends about, you know, teaching. I'd watch my teacher, I'd see what they're doing. And I think that's exactly what I wanted to do. So that passion for teaching has always been there. I genuinely don't know if I could do any other job. Even today, I struggle. Because, you know, when you get frustrated and you want to leave the classroom and you're thinking, I need an out. I love teaching so much. I don't know if I'm ever going to quit. It's just always been there.
That's awesome.
I was 20 when I came.
Early doors. So that's a lot of new things to take in.
It was so many new things. You know, my first ever job when I arrived was McDonald's, and I survived it for 3 days.
You probably did more than most, to be honest with you. What was the straw that broke the camel's back?
I got offered another job, to be fair.
Okay.
When I came, my aunt, who I came to live with, she was old school. So she had me filling in applications, knocking on doors, putting my CV through doors and walking around, you know, the old fashioned way. And I was just like, this woman is driving me crazy. And I lived in East Ham, and I got a McDonald's job in Waltham store. So okay. The journey. And I was just like, I'm not impressed by this. And, you know, I got there, did my 3 days. And on the third day when I got home, a letter came through saying I had an interview for another job. I was just like, yep. I went straight to the next job, which was at the bingo hall. And that itself was another experience. I did not know that people played bingo like that.
Too extreme. It's an extreme sport in the UK.
It was such a culture shock.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think it was about a month later, I found another job, which was the best job. And I stayed in that job all throughout my time at uni. And that was in Ladbrokes, the betting company.
Okay.
That, you know, I really genuinely enjoyed that job. It was so good. I learned so much. It was also the job I had my first racist experience.
Fun times.
Believe it or not.
Do you know what's funny is that I was actually going to say that it seems by those three jobs before even going into the classroom, you seem like you're very well versed for the classroom.
Exactly. I was so prepared for it, honestly.
But I'm surprised that it took you until the third job to get a racist experience in the UK, to be honest with you. Even though we talk about it as being like the least racist country in Europe, apparently.
Yeah.
So, okay. So here's a question then. Based on all of that, I guess the notion of Black identity and how you're Blackness has shaped your career so far. It's an interesting one when you are from a Black majority country in and of itself, because I guess the notion of Blackness isn't as apparent, perhaps, as it might be if you grew up where your culture is in contrast to something else, or you are the minority to something else. So in terms of deciding to go into education, I guess that was a more intentional career choice after university. Yeah, how did your Blackness play into any of the decisions that you made?
Well, it's always been who I am, and I've never tried to hide it. So the idea of, you know, not celebrating my Jamaicanness, not laughing out extra loud, or not having my face in a certain way when I'm not actually feeling the vibes of the place, those things are just innate. They're just, I can't not do them. Do you know what I mean? So I don't know any other way to be to this day. I'll tell you a story about one of the head teachers that I had to explain and put in her place about my faith.
Go for it.
Imagine being called into the head teacher's office and being told that, oh, I've noticed since you've started here, you don't look happy. So I then said, what makes you think I'm not happy? She goes, I didn't say you're not happy. I said, you don't look happy. So I said, do I have to look happy to be happy? And if that is the case, does my looking happy have anything to do with the amount of work and my performance? To which she had no answer. So I said, you know what? This is my face. This is my resting face. And this is who I am.
Resting Jamaican face.
Exactly. And I just walked out and I was so mad. And I just think, how dare you? How dare you say the appearance of my face and, you know, how I look has no ability on me doing my job. No. You know, when the Beckys, they always smile and they're super hyper and they do nothing. They literally just swan around, have a conversation with this person, have a conversation. And then when it comes to the kids and being productive, zero production. But because they're always happy, they're approachable and it's nice to have the Beckys. But you just get on with your work and your face is set in a way because my face always reflects my mood and it just comes through. But yeah, so I'm black ass. I'm black ass. It's there in every single space.
It sounds as though you have a clear identity of who you are. It sounds as that you have a clear point of view as to how you see the world and go about doing your things. Yes. And so I guess then thinking about what that has meant in terms of some of the formative experiences and lessons, I mean, you've already alluded to one.
I think it was about at the end of my third year at uni, I realized that I was genuinely a black woman. Because like I said, growing up in Jamaica, the idea of being black was never something I worried about. I was just a girl doing a thing and getting on like everybody else. So I came with that same mindset and I was just a person doing my thing. But every time I get asked, fill this box in, and I had to go black, fill this in, black Caribbean, black this, black that, or that black girl over there, or this black. And then it dawned on me, like, I'm actually black. Not that I didn't know. I'm not saying that I didn't know.
But it has a different meaning and a different weight.
Yeah. Being in the UK forces you to identify and to own it. And I'm just like, but I'm just a person, just like the other person over there. And do you know what I mean? I didn't think I had to lead with being black. But then once I understood that, I was just like, you know what? You're getting all of it. I'm not going to dumb it down. I'm not going to hide it. This is me in who I am, in all my glory. Take me or walk away. And going out in uni as well, I met my son's dad. He's half British, half German. Where we got together, the nuances, you know, the simple things that we had to navigate in our relationship was for me fun times because I had amazing fun teaching him, like, this is not how you do that. Don't ever say that to a black person. Do this. Do you know what I mean? And he was very receptive to it and he understood it. And it was great. But I say that to say that is when I really understood that I was genuinely a black person. Because we'd go into some spaces, like for restaurants, and when I go and I say, oh, dinner for two, I'd be like, yeah, we'll be with you in a minute. And then he comes along and they go, oh, sir, can I help you? Straight away. And they're like, oh, here we go. There's a seat available ready for him. And I was like, huh, I see you. I see you, Britain. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And like, but on my own, I'd never actually thought or even recognized those things. Do you know what I mean? But being with him, those things just That's when I knew, you know, I was truly, and that's the third year, my final year when, you know, we were dating. And that just really sealed the deal for me that I was a Black woman living in Britain. Mm-hmm. I wasn't just a girl. The Black was first, then the girl. So that's when I genuinely felt it. And I thought, okay, let's go to work. Yeah.
So in going to work then, tell me about how that was for you when you first arrived into the schooling system. Like, what was that like for you in terms of, because your, what's your subject? Your humanities, right?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, how was that for you?
At the time, again, that was fine because that was in 2006. I was just finished being a staying at home mom. I took a year out, you know, for my son, and I literally just done my GTP and I got into school. And it was my first full-time teaching job, and I was so happy because I did my GTP qualifications whilst pregnant. So I did it, got passed, and then took That's a year impressive. Had my son, and then came back into it. And I taught for a year. I wasn't, you know, like previously, I know that if you do the PGCE, you get a mentor and all of that. I wasn't given anyone. I was just let to roam. And after my first year, the deputy head called me into her office and asked me if I wanted to apply for the assistant head of year job. And that genuinely was not on my radar because I was just literally trying to get through my teaching to get home to my son. So when she approached me and said, do you want to do it? I was like, yeah, it's more money. That's what I'm about. So, you know, I said, yes. And I was an assistant head of year for about 2 years. I genuinely worked so hard, worked trying to understand the British school system because that was genuinely still new to me. And learning the syllabus of the subjects I was teaching, because by then, you know, teaching humanities, you don't just teach one. So I had to come history, geography, RE, and I was teaching sociology, which is my I'd have my degree in. So learning all of that. And I can say, Marlon, in Jamaica, it's such a monocultural country that I didn't know anything about Islam, nothing about Judaism, nothing about Sikhism. So I had to teach myself these things. The only religion I knew about was Christianity. Imagine teaching and not knowing and just like being so, so in the dark. So every day I'd have to read up.
But then, slow it down for a second, right? Because, yeah, Jamaica's monocultural by comparison to Britain. So you have an excuse, if you wanted one, as to why you don't know about these people. Britain is not monocultural, but Britain would like to present itself as being monocultural. And so it does not have the same excuse to not know about any of these other religions. So the nonsense that we often get about halal and Sharia law and kosher and all these other foolishness that people have is reflective of the socialization that a lot of Brits have, where they choose not to engage with the multicultural that is on their doorstep in the UK. Versus actually having, you know, a Jamaica which is monocultural, monoreligious to a great extent, where, you know, that is a bit more of a ready-made excuse as to why you wouldn't know. But then also the other piece that you said, which is why I'm really slowing it down, is that you said that you had to learn it partly to do your job effectively. But I don't know, and maybe you can speak to this, but the sort of curiosity aspect of, well, I know nothing about these people, so let me get to knowing about these people, is something that could only really happen if you do not have automatic suspicion of what these people are like in learning about them. So if you've already kind of been primed to say that all Muslims are negative, then you're going to be looking out for all the ways in which you can reinforce the view that they're all negative. Whereas if you're just like, let me learn about Islam because I don't know nothing about it and I need to learn it objectively to teach the people, my kids, you're going to be far more curious to learn potentially all the sides of the thing, or at least the technical sides of the thing, before you start applying people to it. So it's just something I wanted to slow down for a bit, because I think that, you know, you could give yourself a disservice by saying that you're brought up in a monocultural society, but that's true for Jamaica. That is not true for the UK. So potentially there are British people out there who have less knowledge of Muslims, having grown up right next door to one, especially being in East London, or much parts of the country, actually, thinking about it, many parts of the country, then you would have the excuse for growing up in Jamaica. So yeah, we're not trying to give anyone passes on this.
No, you're right. I did learn about it because of the people I was with, and I wanted to know more about the students that I was serving, and I wanted to do a good job, and I wanted for myself to have that knowledge and understanding. So I did my research, and you know, I equipped myself so I would be a better person, and hopefully, you know, try and help them to understand, because as we know, most of these students don't actually know what's going on. You've got to be that guide. Yeah.
So with becoming assistant head of year, I mean, I really like the fact that you just said that it wasn't to do, at least from your end, it wasn't to do with identity, it wasn't to do with anything. I mean, it probably might have been from their end that you're probably holding the kids to a particular level of expectation that others may not have been. But I like that you're just very transactional about it, like more money equals more things at home for my kid that I've got. So therefore, that's what we're doing it for. So how did that influence anything that you were doing? Did that have any formative experiences for you, even in terms of juggling work, maybe with home life and just being, I guess, ruthless as a head of year to get it done?
Yeah, it was extremely transactional because, like, again, maybe I was blind to it, but I didn't view anything as, and I wouldn't go into something looking for an agenda, whereas now I do, which is really, you'd say, it's experience, it's growth. So I do that now. But then I, like I said, you know, I was just a girl trying to get on. I didn't see myself as being Black. I was just this person trying to do what everyone else seemed to be doing. I didn't have an agenda, so therefore I didn't think anyone else had an agenda.
For sure.
So I just got on with it. It changed when I became head of year, because there was another candidate going up for it, and obviously I beat that candidate to the post, and they said it was sour grapes, and that's when I had my first dose of, oh, we're going to give it to you because you've done it before, however so and so would have done it because they could have learned the ropes. And I was just like, I don't understand. What do you mean by that?
And why did I need to know that? What's that got to do with my interview?
That was the feedback. Because I know previously you talked about, you know, feedback and how feedback motivates or help people to move forward. But that was my feedback. It wasn't my feedback.
Yeah, exactly. Like, why would you tell me about the other candidate? I don't care about that.
That was not my feedback. And that's when I realized that there is an agenda and I need to be wise to the agenda. And that, for me, was okay. I'm on this British thing now. I've been here long enough. I need to step my game up. Totally. Yeah. And again, for most of it, I was doing well. I was surviving. I was getting home. I was seeing my son. And I was doing my job. And that's all that mattered to me at then. I genuinely had nothing else to do. I didn't want to be an assistant head. I wasn't looking for a promotion. I just wanted my son to be okay. I just wanted it, you know, him to be close by so I can grab him from school and, you know, we go home together, which is what we did every day. So when he finished primary school, and I'd been at that school for almost 10 years, I was like, okay, I need to move. I need to, you know, see what's out there.
So those sound like some really formative experiences that you've had. And I really think about the span and the arc of the three jobs that you had before teaching. One of your earliest experiences in school being told about your persona and that being the feedback that you're given. So thinking about how actually being a young mother at the time as well was guiding a lot of your decisions that you were making. And that sounds like it's a lot to juggle. It's a lot to consider. And again, what you're saying actually that your awareness of self was growing over time. So not everything was aware to you right from the jump. So I guess in thinking about that, there would have been some near misses or some potential cock-ups or some parts of your career journey that were a bit turbulent, I guess. And I wonder if you'd be able to speak to some of those and what that taught you in those moments.
Yes, thank you. I had a really interesting near miss. So I've been at this school for almost 10 years. And I was, you know, like I said, considering leaving, but it was not a big deal if I stayed because, you know, I had fantastic friends, worked really hard, loved the kids, and the school was a good school. So there, you know, if I had to stay, it wouldn't be the end of the world. During the time I was thinking about what my next step should be, a vacancy came up for a assistant head in charge of behavior. And I thought, oh, let's give this a go. So normally you probably speak to the head teacher to find out, you know, what they're thinking, you know, where their head's at. I thought, I'm not going to do that. I've been here long enough. I'm just going to go for it and see what will happen. So I did. I wrote my letter in. It was accepted. And the other candidate, it's only two of us, was on maternity leave at the time. So I was told that the interview would not be able to happen for another 2 or 3 weeks, given that this person was still on maternity leave and they wanted to be fair to the person, yada, yada, yada. And I was like, cool, no problem. So we waited, and then it came around to the time for the interview. On the day of the interview, I was made aware that this is a day, and I'm like, cool. I went home, I spoke to people, I did my usual prep, and I was ready to go. Went to school, saw my name was not on the cover list, which I thought was really odd because you've got an interview. So I found the person in charge of cover. They go, no one's told them anything. So as far as they're concerned, I'm teaching my lesson. So I taught my first two lessons. Then I saw the other candidate and I went over and I was like, oh, so hectic. And they're like, no, it's not hectic. I've been here all day. I've done my first task already. I'm now chilling and waiting to do my next task in a bit. And I was just like, I haven't even been given
information, much less a task. Yeah.
Yeah. So I didn't even know where the process had started. Right. So I went and I spoke to one of the assistant head and they were like, oh my goodness, I can't believe this has happened. Let's go sort this out. And, you know, 10 minutes later, my name appeared on the cover list. And, you know, I got this agenda that said my time is now during break. So I said, okay, fine. And I went and I did my first task. And then I did my second task. And then it was interview time. At the end of the interview, I was told that I would not be hearing from them on the day because they've got to think about it and make a decision. And I was like, okay, fine. The next day, I wasn't in school because I was at a conference. So I genuinely didn't hear anyways. So on the conference, at the end of the conference, I remember my phone ringing and I having to run out of the conference going, I've got to take this call. And I was told, oh, you haven't been successful because we've decided to go with the other person, but we're happy to give you feedback. And I was like, great, yeah, no problem. I'm happy to get the feedback. So feedback was arranged about 2 days later. I went in for the feedback and I was like, right, so yes, I'm happy to hear the feedback. What's the feedback? Oh, we just think that some of your answers, especially this one, was a bit too fast. We didn't think that you slowed your answer down enough to tell us what you wanted to hear. And I'm saying it in that tone because that's how they spoke to me. And you know, it's something that's, what? Yeah. So I said, I didn't get the job because my answer was too fast. Is that what you're saying? Because I'm direct and I'm going to ask you straight because that's what you're saying to me. And I was like, no. It's not just that one thing, but, you know, that was really important for us. And I was like, okay, so why did I really genuinely not get the job? Because basically, just tell me, level, because I've been here a long time. You know me, I know you, just level. And yeah, we just think that the other person would be a better fit. And I was like, okay. That's the reason. Thank you. So then I just started looking for jobs because that's the school you want with that sort of people. Do you know what I mean?
No, absolutely.
There you go.
Absolutely.
So I left that thinking two things. One, I could have walked away thinking I'm not good enough and I didn't know what I was doing. And that could have scarred me. But I chose not to think that because I knew I am good enough and I know that, you know what, I am way better. But I didn't want to be an assistant head. I've never wanted to be one, to be honest. But the opportunity came up and I thought, why not? It might be something that you might be good at, but you just don't know it yet. Do you know what I mean? Because it's still in teaching. But genuinely, walking away from that experience, that's when another thing I thought, okay, Britain, second punch in the face. Thank you very much. Literally. So on my exit interview from that job, one of the questions was, do you think the school is racist? And I wrote in big, bold letters, yes. So then I told him about the experience and he said, ah, it feels like sour grape. Yeah.
So let's just backtrack then.
Yeah.
Because I'm getting hot, even just having you explain it to me. So you both apply for a role.
Yep.
You're told to wait for someone else who is available to be in this space on the day when you're, or during the time that you're able to do the interview, and accommodations were made for that person.
Yeah.
And then on the day itself, you are not given any cover. You're not given any means or tools to effectively go into this thing to compete on a level playing field.
Yep.
And then you go in, you speak to the other candidate, and I mean, I wasn't there, so I don't know what kind of air attitude they had, but if there's an air attitude of this job is mine, I wouldn't be surprised, because that you mentioned that they said that, you know, the task has been easy and everything's been a cakewalk, and I've not felt any hardship along this process, which on a macro level, is that not privilege? And so then for you to then go into, you know, the interview, do your interview on the dot, no prep for the task, you know, you've just come off off-ramped of teaching, you've literally gone into this interview. I mean, as I'm replaying it back without the story, just the facts of the matter, you can start to already see the obstacles and the barriers that were intentionally put up in your path to go there. And so then when you're now then told that you're not the right fit, it's funny because fit is one of the top five, if you like, supremacist answers that really means nothing, but means everything as to why we don't want you in the job. And so fit is, are you too, are you not enough? And really and truly, if you want to link it back to your first school experience, fit is me telling you that you don't smile enough, because the fit of this school is that we smile through everything and we don't ever show our emotions toward things because we have a bias, a negative bias towards emotion. And so in that school, you need to be happy 24/7 for the time that you're in that school. And in this setting, you don't even know what your fit was or what the lack of fit was. But apparently my girl who was on maternity leave and coming back to the school was the fit that they wanted and not yourself. And, you know, I'm really glad that you raised the point about knowing self-worth and being able to separate the fact that actually this process is shit. I am not shit. And so as a result, you can keep your shit. I'm all right with that. That I think is an important thing to recognize, because many people, especially many Black people, and it's not just education, but specifically as you know, this podcast is focused on, will leave a career. So I was looking at a statistic in Canada. There's a report that's happened, and there's a similar one done by Runnymede actually, that says that at any one time, 77% of racialized people, so I guess BAME would be the equivalent, are on high alert with intent to quit their job. So they have an emotional tax that they have to also weather on top of doing the job. So on top of doing that which is your role, there's also, do I fit? Am I to this? Am I not enough that? And these are all the things that are not on a job description. These are all the things that have nothing to do with the role. And so it just seems to me, based on what you're saying, that like there's a piece to talk about that, because the system itself would happily squeeze you out and say that you are not fit. You're not the right fit for the system. So as a result, the flaw is you. You are flawed for the system because everyone else can do it. Why are you unable to do it without the system realizing that it has, as said, on the setup to this interview, done everything in its power to forget to invite you, neglect to put you on cover, even the helpful, oh my God, let's rectify this situation. It's not like that's one half of it. The other half is, and then let me go and bollock the person who let this happen, because that is also the allyship behind the scenes, which is to also say, but well, how could Susan have ever had a fair fight in this game if we had set it up in a way that would have not shown her best side? That would have been the additional part of someone in that senior leadership position to go back to senior leadership and say, we've already set it up in a way where we can't get an equal or an objective response. And so then for the school to finally say, oh, are we racist? Well, don't ask the question if you don't want the answer.
The icing on the cake, Marlon, was about a week after, you know, when this person is now fulfilling the role and doing the job, and everyone's like, oh, yeah, she's, you know, she's here. To be stopped in the corridor by a SLT who used to be in charge of humanities when I was there and all of that. So, you know, somebody that I'm quite, not friends, because they're always colleagues, but I know really well, reasonably well, in a work setting. Yeah. To stop me in the corridor and say, oh, you've done really well in how you've reacted to not getting the job. And I just looked at her and thought, what do you expect me to?
What do you expect? Because you're baiting me.
I'm assuming that for her, she was expecting me to either throw a massive tantrum in the corridor so everyone could see. But the fact that I was gracious and did what they expected, which was not to say anything about it, just went, okay, thank you very much, and congratulated the person and kept on working with them and just being, you know, doing my job because that's what I get paid to do. And I'm like, that's your politics. That's for you to rectify and to deal with. It's not going to bother me and how I operate because I know who I am and I know what I'm worth. And like I said, that's when I started looking. But I thought it was really such a dig for that person to come up to me and go, oh, I thought you responded quite nicely. Because for them, that is a nice response. Absolutely. Because I didn't throw a massive tantrum. Absolutely. And the other thing is, like I said, I started looking for a job. So then I got the job as a head of year at another school, but this is at an outstanding school. Another SLT member said to me, I can't believe you got a job at an outstanding school. Yeah. And I said, I know you wouldn't believe that, and just walked away. Because, again, I have no time. I genuinely have no time. Do you know what I mean? But that's where their expectations of me is. And I remember asking the head on my interview when he goes, is the school racist? And I said, yes. And I then said to him, did you have a plan for me? If I stayed, where did you see me in 2 years' time? And his answer was, well, you know, we're going into March, so we could, and I'm just like, yeah, you hadn't even thought about me. I'm not one of the persons that you would think about when you're thinking about your staff. Do you know what I mean? I'm not on your radar at all. This is not the place for me. So I need to find somewhere where I'm valued and I'm worth. People see my worth and want to move with me. So that was my near miss.
Thank you for that.
So, yeah.
No, thank you for that. That is poignant. That is poignant. And there's so many parts to pull out from that. And I really hope, that people see themselves reflected in that. Like, even to the point that you say, where would you see me in 3 or 4 years' time? Like, that is that's the question that's always asked of us. Like, what do you feel like you can contribute to this system in 3 or 4 years' time? But it's never asked of what does the system think it can give back to you in the same amount of time. And it's interesting how, you know, I go back to the whole piece around the expectation is that we are gracious in the face of adversity all the time, that even though an interpretation, a valid one, is that, you know, you not kicking up a stink is you reacting so graciously. There's also a piece that's interesting in terms of the word choices that you said she used, that you reacted so well is one half of the coin. It's one face of the coin. The other face of the coin, though, is reflected back to the organization that says, but we didn't act well. So she's reacted well in spite of our poor actions versus you know, it's an unfinished or an unclosed loop that thank you for being gracious, but we have, therefore, we have nothing to reflect on our end as to what we have done to potentially cause you to act out of a character that you typically have. And then I think about how that is kind of typically, again, the gaslighting piece. It's the idea that when you now leave and you raise these things, the argument is, well, I didn't know it at the time. Well, at the same time, it wasn't safe for me to say it at the time, because had I said it at the time, that would have absolutely have been my concrete ceiling now, that you would have started to take things away from me because I am ungrateful in defeat. So When is the best time to give you feedback? Because even in giving you feedback to say that you're racist, you're still telling me no.
I want to tell you about one more
Go.
And this is one of the main reasons I've left my current school. I put it in the chat, the group chat that we have, when it happened to me, when I experienced my first ever outright racism from students, because like I said, I've taught in London for over 10 years. I've never had a racist experience, and I've been at this school and I've had two. Right. And I was just like, what is going on in this place? So the first one, the kids, year eight, they were watching, we were looking at rather the slave trade, Middle Passage, you know, all the way we teach it with, yeah, hey, white people saved us from abolition of slavery. Let's be grateful to them. And it was a lesson in class where they had that video from Amistad where they were doing the triangular trade, and they were on the boat and they were speaking some African language, some African dialect, and everyone was watching and being really gripped by, oh my goodness, I can't believe this is happening. And one of the students jumped out, Miss, what are they saying? So I went, I don't know. She goes, why don't you know? And I was like, why do you think I would know? But you're black, so you should know. So I went, I'm not from Africa, and I don't know. I don't even know if this is what they're saying is actually an African dialect, to be fair, because you know what they're like in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. And she stepped on, but you're black, so you should know, you should know, you should know. So the kids were like, why are you being racist? Stop being racist. I'm not being racist. And, you know, it went back and forth. Anyways, at the end of the lesson, I wrote it all up, sent it all in. Then I had my line manager come, what happened? Give the spiel, told them what happened. Okay, write it up. I've already done that. Send it. I've already done that. Okay. Here's my manager come. What happened? So I did that third time, right? You can't do the same thing third time. This is my guy to me. Okay. I've called her dad. Her dad is coming in. Can you come and tell him what happened?
How many times do you want me to go for the same blasted story at this point?
Yeah. And I was just, no. So then I went in the room because, you know, you've been told to go and do something. So I went in the room and the dad was there and he hit me with, let me tell you something. My daughter isn't racist because we've got a black member in the family. So I just said, glad to know, and left. I was not doing the meeting. I walked out. So then I got a call from the guy the next day asking me to meet him in his office. And I went and he was just like, oh, I said, no. I'm not doing it. I said, I wrote it down. I've recounted it three times. I'm not doing it a third or fourth time. And he was like, okay, but. I was like, there's no but. There really isn't. And that was that. So I think sometime later, he got the girl to come and apologize to me. And I was just like, yeah, we both know this is not really a thing, but we went to the motion. And that was it. And then the thing, the camera that brought my back was two girls from my year group, two Romanian girls came in, and there'd been an incident the day before in a lesson where one of the Romanian girls had called a black boy in the lesson a monkey, and the teacher had written it all up and everything. So my job was to go in as a head of year and, you know, investigate and find out exactly what had gone on. So I'd done that, and one of the girls was like, why are you coming to find out, you know, this is that, I've done it already. And I was like, I know, but the process is, you have to stay here until we find out, you know, we get to the bottom of it. We've got to interview a few more kids and blah, blah, blah. She's like, fine. So then anyways, at the end of the day, she was annoyed that she hadn't been in lessons because she was isolated from attending lessons, you know, in an inclusion room or whatever you want to call it. She came into my office. You made me miss school today. You made me miss the whole school today. You know what? You're the monkey. Right? And I was just like, right. And then a friend comes in after and goes, Miss, did she just call you a monkey? Because if she did it, you should know that you're a monkey. And left. And I was just sat there thinking, what had just happened? So on cue, my line manager walks in. And she was like, oh, by the way, can you? And I just looked at her with my face that said, I'm not okay. This is not happening. And she goes, oh, are you all right? So I went, no, not actually. And I told her what had just happened. And she goes, oh, I'm sorry to hear that. Can you do and roll off a list of things that I need to get done? Yeah. So I was just like, cool. Did her list, went home, pissed as. And then I put it in the group and I asked everyone in the group, you know, what should happen? How should I go about this? What should I do? And, you know, quite helpful, love the support of the group. And, you know, it was great. Next day I went to school. I was told to justify my statement because they weren't sure what I meant by certain things. And I was just like, right, okay. So straight away, they're questioning what I had to say and how the incident happened to me. That's fine. I'll play a game, which I did. Then I was told, okay, they're looking into it and they'll get back to me. After 2 days, no one said anything to me. So then I was just like, what is going on? Then I think it was about 9 o'clock on the evening of the second day, I got an email saying that the girls have been excluded for 2 days. And I was just like, wow, okay, 2 days, fine. So obviously I'm fuming and I went in and my line manager was like, what's wrong? So I told her, she's like, okay, we can deal with it in line meeting. And I'm like, cool. So I'll get to say my piece, I, you know, get it off my chest. Line meeting, it was just, okay, fine. Yeah, but we've sanctioned them. And why are you still upset about this? And I was just like, clearly you don't understand and you're just not even trying to understand. So there's no point in me having this conversation.
At all.
So I just stopped. And just let them carry on with whatever they were doing. So in the evening, I was still fuming, still annoyed. So at the weekend, I wrote to my head everything, putting it all out, saying how I felt, how the whole thing was dealt with, that nobody came to speak to me, no one found out how I was, the racist incident was just treated. You know, 2 days, that's what you give for defiance. 2 days for somebody that, you know, wasn't happy with something. And then a boy that stole from the canteen got 5 days. And I was like, okay, that's how we're playing this game. 5 days exclusion for stealing.
Two days for racist incident.
Yeah. So in the end, we had Ofsted. So of course she couldn't speak to me. The head teacher couldn't speak to me. 11 days after Ofsted had gone, 11 days after that was the first time she acknowledged that she's received the email and she was able to meet with me another 2 weeks after that. So we're talking about a full month by now. Yeah. And obviously by the time I got into her office, it was just going through the motion and her going, yeah. So I was just like, and during that time, another teacher had received racist abuse as well. Which when I heard, I went and I spoke to the teacher to find out how they were and, you know, just normal human decency to say, I'm sorry you had that experience. I'm sorry these kids don't know any better because we don't teach them and this school is not the place because they're not even trying. And during that time at this school, a student had come to me 2 separate occasions where they'd written "go home" in the toilet, or the boys' toilet, twice. And every time I raised it, all they did was wipe it off. So it didn't happen. Do you know what I mean? And I was just like, why don't we do an assembly where we talk to the kids? Yeah, but it's not really a problem, I was told. It wasn't really a problem. So we didn't need to do an assembly and make a big deal about it because they find that in their wisdom that if you go and tell kids about a problem, then it just makes it into a bigger thing. And it's not a thing, so we're not going to highlight it for them. And by the way, they only wrote that because they were doing their English book where it would have come up in that English book that they were reading, the literature book. So it's not really a problem. Okay, fine.
So many parts to unpack. I was on a webinar recently and I was talking about how we are often asked to relive our trauma from white people. And the actual perspective that I took it from, and I'm going to raise it here, is I remember when I was doing some work with the Holocaust. There's a unit that's teaching on the Holocaust. And I reached out to one of the foundations where you can invite a Holocaust survivor into your school to speak about their experience. And I remember in doing this, I think I must have asked the question about how often do they do this. And it was said that, like, we do not ask our Holocaust survivors to go into a school more than once. I think it was once every 2 weeks or once every week. But however it was, there's a gap between, there's a meaningful gap. And the reason that was given is because, you know, the stories that they're going to bring up are so traumatic that we need to give them time for therapy, for counseling, to bring it back down to neutral, to be able to go back into another space and retell the story. And in the abstract, in not related to anything, I was like, oh, that's really nice. That's really conscientious. That's a great thing for what they've been through and how tough life has been for them. It makes sense, right? But in what you've just said, you received it. Can you replay it to me? Can you replay it to me? Can you replay it to me? So 3 to 4 times you were asked to relive that moment in the classroom, which wasn't a private incident. It wasn't a interpersonal incident. It was with an audience, that you were asked to relive this account over and over and over and over. I just want to really draw the parallel between how we prioritize and make precious some groups in our society. And that's on a national level to an extent. Like, we make it very clear that there are some stories that are so sacred and some experiences that are so sacred that we have to always be mindful and respectful to the experiences that certain people have had historically. But then for other people, it's okay if you just keep drawing from the well of humiliation, of hardship, of all of those, because at this point it's not a microaggression, it's a macroaggression. And somehow that well is supposed to be never ending. And you can keep, again, I'm going to go right back to the point that I was saying before about how we're supposed to be gracious in the face of all of the negative things that come our way. That's just one thing I want to leave unended, because I feel like the point has been very clearly made in terms of what I'm saying. And then secondly, the point around school policies are intended to be murky, I believe, on purpose, because it is unclear as to what a person is getting sanctioned for. So the idea that racism can, like, and I would hazard a guess that what they were suspended for in the end probably wasn't racism, but was probably something else that was, I don't know, defiance to a teacher, disrespect, some other term or whatever else that was used, the label that was used. And maybe racism was written up in the text box that you have to expand to see what was actually going on, because it wasn't the headline, because potentially we don't even have a category for racism in the school because it doesn't exist here. But for that to be, I just want the parity to be also understood here. Homophobia, sexism, racism do not carry the same weight in schools. In terms of a suspension, in terms of how the policy is written, in terms of even universality of policy. So, you know, it seems to me that if this were a football match and my girls had been clocked one time being racist, that would have been a yellow card, no? So the second time they're clocked for doing it would be a red card, right? But it seems to me as though the second time that they were clocked for doing it was almost to suggest as though it's even a lower infraction than the first time, because the dismissing of it even happening to you and you just being told, but here's my shopping list. Sorry that, you know, you've had a bit of an inconvenience to your day, but if you could just, is to suggest as though it's even less of a thing for you to take on board than would have been the case when it was leveled from student to student. Which, again, you know, draw a parallel back to you and your son and the idea that the teacher is able to throw around their power in that moment. You are somehow supposed to show your power in restraint. You're supposed to absorb all of that, because in the end, you're the powerful one. They're just kids. They don't know what they're saying. They don't know what they mean. Versus your son, who just by sheer attendance in the PE lesson is threatening to that teacher who doesn't know how to make use of her power in that moment. So it's just, you know, a couple of lines to draw in that, because I think it's really important that, you know, people who are listening start to understand some of the patterns that are taking place there. Thank you for sharing that. I like this. And I mean, we haven't even talked about Guyana. We haven't even spoken about anything. No, it's great. We haven't even spoken about any of that, but maybe it comes up here when we think about how you've navigated taking up space to feel comfortable in your Blackness across your career. And I think, you know, from just reflecting back to you, it's not been a conscious thing to begin with. You've just been Susan. And then at some stage you've become Black Susan. So I guess there's even a journey in that of feeling comfortable wearing that label to now taking a space with that label. And I just wonder what that journey has looked like for you over time.
It definitely has changed a lot. Cause like, you know, when I decided to apply for the program to go to Guyana, one of the reasons was that I've always wanted to go back and teach in Jamaica, but that has not been possible for a number of reasons. And then that opportunity came up and I was like, ah, it's not Jamaica, but it's as close as, you know what I mean? Because I left, like I said, at 20 and I've just never actually given back. So I still, to this day, one of my biggest things that I really want to do is to go back and build a school and just give back. Or I'm trying to make partnership with teachers that are in Jamaica to make sure that, you know, there's some, on some level that I can do something to give back, because I think it's really important that I do that. So Guyana was like, okay, fine, let's go. And my best friend, my son's godmother, is from Guyana as well. So it was like, fine, let's go see it. Let's go. And she was going as well. So I was like, yep, definitely going. So yeah. And it was good because being there just reminded me so much of being in the Caribbean, being in Jamaica, being at home, and I just felt in my element. The thing that stood out for me, I don't know if you remember where we went to the commission, the British commissioner.
Oh, gosh.
The barbecue.
Yeah, bring it up.
Yeah, that was, in itself, was just such an experience, because here I was in this predominantly Black country at this white man's house. And when I got there, this white man telling and saying hello and being super happy and excited to see all the white people. And then when it got to me, he was just like, oh, hi. And then just carried on. But I made a point. I went back to him and I was like, oh yeah, hi. I'm also from Jamaica. And I forced it on him. And then he felt like he had to speak to me. And once he started to engage, and I walked away, because I was like, I'm not doing that with you. You will recognize that I'm here. Yep. Just like you recognizing that the others are here. He genuinely walked past me, Marlon, like I wasn't there.
As you say this, I remember this, because it was the idea that we had at least a non-white majority country, so Black and Asian majority country, we had this little gated community that this man had built his little fortress. And because he was the British commissioner to Guyana, he had house servants, he had help, they put on the spreads.
Yeah, and a nice pool.
It was opulent. I actually remember that interaction, because I remember it becoming an increasingly obvious thing that you couldn't miss. Because the only reason why I reference it for me is because being the Black man in that moment, I think my saving grace was that I was introduced as leader. And so I think that was the thing that for me, being aware of how I was being viewed, was because one, I had a white man co-sign me who knew him, and the white man co-signed my title as being something to be aware of. And so if I wasn't aware of it, everybody else had to then fend for themselves, right? I remember attending a conference in which I think his name, I want to get his name correct, is a professor. And his work that he was doing, the Jamaican guys were actually, the work that he was talking about was the idea of white sanction. And white sanction, what he was speaking about was to suggest as though oftentimes where Black people get a pass is where they have been sanctioned. So a white person is basically the gatekeeper. has decided on their part that this other Black person that they're with is good Black people to be with. And so in terms of what that meant in that moment, I mean, I never had the words for it at the time, but I now see what the words were. It was to suggest that I was sanctionable, passable, permissible by this other white person in the space who is letting this high commissioner know that me as a Black guy, as the role of leader, is something to take up, like to be aware of. And it's something that I constantly bring up with Black men in particular in the education space, because this is one of those moments where my gender is overriding my race. And so, I mean, I'm somehow now in the boys club because the white man has said that this other Black man is good property. And if the man is not conscientious of gender, that extension will not be given to the women in the space. And so you're left to fend for yourself. And so I remember that moment very vividly, because it was just the weirdest thing that we were just in this gated house surrounded by no other Guyanese people. It wasn't close to any other Guyanese people, but then a few roads away, it just dilapidated. Like, it just wasn't.
Yeah, he could just see that this was not.
Absolutely. Yeah. It was not spread amongst anybody. And I just remember that if you were to take a sort of like postcard picture of it, potentially we would look like the help. You wouldn't even know that we were there as leaders in that space, because there was such a divide between how warm he was with some and how cool and frosty and very transactional he was with others.
That for me, again, just reminded me again, here I am, here's my Blackness. You've got to recognize it, because this is who I am. And I'm not going to let you gloss over me. You're going to acknowledge me in the same way you've been acknowledging all the others. And it was, I think for him, he was quite upset at the end that he was talking and I just walked away. That's what he was doing to me. And it was okay when he was doing it. Do you know what I mean? But when I held him in convo, I said, no, you're not going to listen to me. You're going to listen. And when me done, me go walk, which I did. And he was just like, no.
And the irony of it is, and the audacity to be in a non-white majority country and still carrying on with that flex.
I was just like, no, you're not going to listen to me, especially where I did.
No, not at all. Nothing at me. But so that sounds like it's an apex of your identity. Are there any other moments that like that?
Can you remember the other moment that we had in Guyana when we did this climbing to this? It was such a lovely climb, and we came back. Do you remember that round table convo that we started that descended, and it just had like four people at the end? That was really telling, wasn't it?
You mean you can't be a racialized person easily and omit talking about race? So it kind of was going to happen at some stage, especially given by that point you had an Asian guy and two Black people leading the team. Mm-hmm. You had a number of issues that had happened
with the team itself, and most of it stemmed from privileges and privilege. People thinking that it's okay to be disrespectful in somebody else's country and not follow the rules.
We had one chick go home.
Yeah, because it was just too much. And, you know, just not appreciating that this is not my space. And as we say in Jamaica, circle yourself, you know what I mean?
The other saying that would be useful is can't dance a yard, can't dance a foreign, because this, if you can't do your teaching, like, you were there to teach.
And I just remember that the table conversation was really interesting and we were loving it. And I remember, can I say her name?
It's her name. Martha.
Martha. It was so good. Like, she was amazing at just explaining about, because our experience, even though I'm Black and I'm obviously, you know, a Black woman, our experiences are different. And I don't know, I've never to this day had any experience with the police or, you know, had any dealings with them. But just to hear about her own interaction and, you know, the things that she was talking about growing up in Southeast London, for me, was quite telling about what was happening in the UK. Do you know what I mean? Like, you can still be in the UK and have such different experiences. Absolutely. And that was quite striking. And the fact that every other people just slowly left the table and the conversation because they were feeling a bit uncomfortable and it wasn't them and they're not racist and they didn't do anything, Why are you having this conversation in this country when we're meant to be enjoying ourselves? Can you not just talk about race all the time? Why can't you just be happy and just enjoy the beautiful views and get bitten by the mosquitoes? And let's just talk about that. Well, we can't just leave it because this guy flew in on the plane that's meant to take us out and he brought his family, which means that all of us can't go back.
Right. That was the part that maddened me. No, please talk about it a bit more because that was so obvious.
No, I'm just saying, how can we just not pretend that this is not happening? Mm-hmm. We have to talk about it. We have to talk about, you know, the entitlement that it's okay for me to bring my family and you can just
figure it out.
I don't care what you do, you know, just figure it out because me and my family are going to get back somehow. No, this is all the entitlement that, and you know, the microaggressions that, yeah, but I didn't say anything. And like, okay, so what? Mm-hmm. No. Mm-hmm. And it was just surreal as they just kept on walking out of the room and, you know, going outside and walking away. The four of us just kept on talking. And one person, to be fair, one white person stayed and engaged with us because he was like, I'm not from London. This is my first other interaction. I don't know anything. I'm going to a school in London, so I need to know these things. Right. So talk to me. And he stayed and listened. And he was the only one. Everyone else got up. And even the person that I came with, who taught in a school that is met, do you know what I mean? So you thought that that person would be like, oh, actually, you know, on reflection, these are the people. No, left. So,
therein lies part of why this podcast is here. Therein lies part of the question as to why we are not trusting anybody's actions in 2020 post George Floyd, because it's too easy to decide at some stage, you know what, I feel like I've maxed out, I'm just going to walk away. And that is that's the fragility piece. That's the white fragility piece. It's not to say that you can't have an emotional reaction to it. It's not to say that you can't feel an emotional charge in this conversation, but it's to understand that by prioritizing your emotion over the narrative of the story is to say that the story needs to be minimized so that you can feel okay at the expense of everybody else who is also in the story. So it is fine to take a moment out and say, do you know what, this is a lot, guys. Like, I've got some emotions coming up and I might need to take a moment, but I'm gonna come back and sit in it. But to just leave is to also say that this is not a problem, one that I want to be involved in, and this is not my problem. So over to you guys to deal with the problem for yourself. And hence, there is the cyclical problem of why white involvement in non-white issues is always met with suspicion, because I have to assume that at some stage you're going to decide that it's no longer your fight and you're off. So I'm really enjoying this conversation because the role that I guess that you play in advocating for your blackness, advocating for others' blackness. I mean, specifically, you talked about your own in this. And I know that you've mentioned that you've got a young son. And so thinking about, well, not so young anymore, I guess, from 2006 to now. So thinking about what that has meant for you, the decisions that you've made and how you navigate your space to grow him up into the world that you want him to occupy. What roles have you found your blackness playing in either creating space or navigating it?
It's so tricky. It's such a tricky thing because I am full on with my blackness and I just come 100%. And sometimes I forget, and I say forget, not because I'm being flippant or dismissive. I forget that he's not 100% black, do you know what I mean? He's got half white that he has to reconcile with. So I would be his black mom telling him about his black self and his black this and his black and his black by not highlighting or not recognizing the white side of him, which isn't fair, do you know what I mean? And it's doing him, I think, a little bit of a disservice. But I'm also conscious of the fact that he will never get a pass on the white side of him. He's never going to get that. Do you know what I mean? He's never going to use his white half to have a privilege of whatever. Because every time anyone looks at him, all they see is a mixed race black boy. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And that is what I tell him. So he knows. And then it's really tricky because his dad would do stuff with him in his whiteness, in his white self, that I know will not fly oh, my son. Do you know what I mean? And I have to be that constant, just reminding him. And it is exhausting. And for my son, I think it's quite hard to navigate, like work out who he truly is. Because yes, he knows he's a mixed race boy. Yes, he knows that his dad's white and his mom's black. And yes, he knows that, you know, his mom's Jamaican and blah, blah, blah. But at the same time, he's not 100% black. Do you know what I mean? And there are things that he wants to experience, but society won't allow him to experience. And me constantly telling him is frustrating and irritating. And I get that. But at the same time, I don't know any other way to try to get him to understand that while your dad can go up to this person and say these things and walk away and it would be no skin off anybody's nose, you cannot do that, my black child. Do you know what I mean? And it is really hard for him to get that and understand that it's not the same. There is a difference. There's a massive difference. And like, he goes and he visits his dad's side of the family and they'll do stuff and he'll be included. And obviously, you know, it's all love and happiness and everything. But he recognizes that he gets looks. You know, he goes on holiday with them and he gets looks. You know, he's like, why are they looking at me like this? Why am I being, and why is this? And I'm just going, this is the world we live in.
Yeah.
And he's now of an age where he understands. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he takes it in his stride. And I'm constantly worried about him because he's a young black boy in London, inner London, going to a community school, which we know all the things that can happen and that goes with it. Funny enough, when he was in year 9, I got a letter from the school asking me to come in because he'd had an altercation with his PE teacher. So when I got there and I was sitting down, like the lovely, kind, amazing mom that I am, supporting my child 100%. And I sat there and she led with, your son's very tall. I find him intimidating and he comes across as aggressive. So I had to stop her right there. And I said, you're not going to do that to my child. And she was really genuinely shocked. She had no idea where I was coming from. I said, no, not my son, not today. I said, yes, he is very tall. He's taller than me and I'm his mom. He's not intimidating. He's tall. There's nothing he can do about that. I said, you've got lots of tall white boys in this school, lots of tall Asian boys in this school. There's nothing they can do about their height. That's the first thing. So let's be clear about that.
Something you can do about your reaction though.
Yeah. I said, the fact that he's tall has nothing to do with him being intimidating or not. You can choose to be intimidated by him or not. That's your choice, but he's not intimidating. You make that decision whether or not you're going to be intimidated by him. That's on you. And I said, and as for being aggressive, I'm not even going to speak to that one. What has he actually done? That was it. The meeting was over. Because you couldn't tell me what he'd done. And I'd ask him, I said, what have you done? And he was, you know, a teenage boy, it's just dumb. I didn't even do anything. And he genuinely hadn't even done anything. She just felt that he was a bit talkative and he answered her back. I could tell my son, just like my, you know, Jamaican people, no matter what they tell you off, right. If they're licking, right. Lick their back. So same thing, you know, she said something, he didn't like it. He responded just like anybody else. Like anybody, do you know what else. I mean?
But how dare you do it?
Exactly.
It's the same links and same parallels. Like, you know, how dare you respond to your head teacher who told you that you should smile more in the school? Because the moment that you tell her that, you know, there's, what am I smiling for? You were frozen out of the communication for the rest of the year. You were then told by the SLT when you didn't get the job and you called it out again, you were told that you were ungrateful. And the part that is interesting that people forget is exactly what you just said. Kids, black kids also have a double whammy of not only being black, but not having the power in that space. So by automatic setup, the teacher's the one that has the power to do a lot of the things in that moment. And oftentimes the default is to go to, how can I abuse the power that I have? Because I feel slighted. I feel embarrassed. I feel scared. And, you know, let's draw another link. to the Guyana conversation, how many of these emotions would have been the same thing that those people were feeling as to why they left the conversation? But a difference is that they couldn't petition their case to anybody to say that we made them feel intimidated, or that they didn't enjoy the session, or that they didn't want to be part of the program, or we should be kicked off because the leadership was Black. So who are you going to write your complaint to if it's not going to be me? And who's going to read your complaint if it's not going to be me? So you had to sit and stew in your anger. Whereas for a lot of teachers in schools, they are able to exercise an abuse of power on Black kids. And there is a notion there that we can get away with, because, you know, a whole heap of assumptions are made about Black households. They don't come to school. They don't have a good understanding of the school work, of how the inner workings of school is. But because you are, as you've already mentioned, socializing your kid to be brought up with a very strong understanding of Blackness as it mirrors white society, there's already protections that you're going to have built in to the system. Mm. Thanks for that. Very, very, very powerful reflection. To finish then, I feel like you've given a lot of powerful stories and a lot of powerful, this is not even a story, it's like it's a powerful understanding of who you are. And I wonder if there are any sort of Susanisms, if that's a word, but any reflections that you might have for others about how they might go about navigating what you've managed to navigate up until now.
One of the things, you know, because like I said to you about, you know, my son being mixed race and being with his white dad, like, we've had so many spaces that we've occupied where the attention, the people just always looking at us. And at first, you know, I used to be like a bit shy of thinking, oh my goodness, they're looking, why are they looking? Oh my goodness, you know what I mean? I'm trying to, am I doing anything wrong? Make sure I'm not too loud, make sure I don't say anything, or I might be eating it wrong. Now, watch me now. I own that space. You're looking, you've got a problem. I don't care about you. I'm living my best life. This is so amazing to me. Ask me anything. Go on, ask me. I dare you. Literally. So I own my space. I literally own it. All of me. I'm not, I've been in rooms where I'm the only Black person. Mm-hmm. And I'm just standing in that space, tall, proud, amazing. Bringing my laughter, bringing my patois, just being authentic and being me. So I'd say to anyone, two things. Always be honest with yourself. Love yourself. And genuinely, as much as you can, just be true to you. And everything else will fall into place. People will see that.
Susan, that's been a great conversation. You've taken me back to some situations that I forgot about, and you've definitely given me more appreciation to who you already are. Cheers for being on this episode and giving your perspective on things.
Thanks for having me.
So Jamaican, no problem.